LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Gregory Shushan, who joins us to discuss his book, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. Taking readers on a thought-provoking journey into our ancestors' beliefs about death, dying, and the afterlife, Shushan reveals the powerful influence of near-death experiences, otherwise known as NDEs, on religious beliefs and ritual practices throughout human history. Focusing on five ancient world religions in Egypt, Mesopotamia, India, China, and Mesoamerica, the author expertly explores each civilization's afterlife beliefs. He explains how each of these civilizations developed independently of one another, yet there is a series of similarities among afterlife beliefs too consistent and specific to be mere coincidence. This leads to the profound implication that afterlife beliefs are not entirely invented by cultures. They also stem from universal truths derived from NDEs. Drawing on anthropology, psychology, and philosophy, the author explores how each civilization interpreted NDEs and how afterlife beliefs develop over time. He also explores the metaphysical implications of his discoveries, including what an actual afterlife would look like. Revealing that NDEs have occurred throughout human history, Shushan shows how they continue to influence our understanding of what lies beyond death to this day. Hello and welcome, Gregory, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks for having me on, Greg. I appreciate it.
Now, today we're talking about your latest book that's entitled Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. Before we jump into that, just for people who are not familiar with your background and work, if you could just give us a little potted bio.
I started out in Egyptian archaeology and Eastern Mediterranean archaeology at UCL, University College London. I was at the Institute of Archaeology. Before that, I was at Birkbeck. And then I sort of defected to religious studies because I found myself focusing more on the ancient texts rather than the material culture. And it just seemed that religious studies would maybe be a better fit for that. And so then I moved to University of Wales in Lambeter, where my supervisor there was Professor Paul Badham, who's fairly well known in near-death studies circles. And he sort of got what I wanted to do with the project. He had looked at cross-cultural NDEs himself. So then I did that project. That was for the ancient civilizations. And then eventually I moved to, I did a postdoc at Oxford at the Ian Ramsey Center for Science and Religion. And that was on near-death experience in indigenous religion. So I've kind of really focused on research much more than teaching. And it's been a fairly continuous progression for the last 25 years or so.
Okay, so in my recorded introduction, I've said a little bit about the nature of the near-death experience. But I'm sure that what I expect after your long decades of work and research in this area, that if you meet someone who'd never heard the term before, you know, in an elevator or on a bus or something, they said, what's a near-death experience? You've worked up some kind of potted explanation for them. So how do you respond to that basic question?
Yeah, I sort of go for the minimal basic explanation, which I see as it's a person comes near death or they temporarily die in a clinical sense. And during that period, they have experiences that seem to take place outside the body. And they have a certain, those experiences can vary depending on the person. And then they come back to the body and are able to talk about it. And the reason I have that minimal explanation is because I don't want to impose the kind of Western model that everyone's familiar with on NDE's crust culturally. I want to sort of be open to whatever different individuals tell us. Because even going back to Raymond Moody and Life After Life, the book is 50 years old now, even he was saying no two NDEs are exactly the same. No two of them have all of the same 15 or so elements that he'd isolated. So I just think that's the context is the main thing, but it does have to have that, mystical or spiritual journey of the soul. It's not just I almost got hit by a bus and stepped back from the curb and I'm okay.
Yeah, of course, that's just a physical one, a purely physical one. Well, to me, when I was reading your book, I was perhaps not surprised, but I suppose I was a little taken aback by the extent to which people, who'd done research or work around near-death experiences weren't getting what I thought was a blindingly obvious link about, to quote the title of your book, The Origins of the World, World's Afterlife Beliefs, because to me it was like, well, yeah, of course. What wouldn't that make sense? It makes complete sense that people down the millennia, all around the world, have been having these, experiences with similar threads in them, and mapping that across to all the different, ancient and indeed modern civilizations. What cultures all around the world through all of time have had to say about what happens after we die, heaven and hell and all of that. So. Yeah, I was a little bit taken aback that these people would look at your work, for example, in this area and go, really?
It's an interesting progression in near-death studies because, Raymond Moody was a psychologist. All the kind of prominent NDE researchers, Kenneth Ring, Bruce Grayson, they all come from medical backgrounds, essentially. And the central question has always been, are these experiences evidence of an afterlife? How can we get proof of that? What kind of veridical information can people having NDEs bring back, and how can we, in what way do those prove the existence of another world and the survival of the soul after death? But it took really a long time for anybody to start looking at them cross-culturally, and then especially to look at them in their cross-cultural distinctiveness and respecting their diversity and trying to understand them in terms of the history and culture of the actual society, rather than just looking at them as like a universal experience that might prove the afterlife. So there's like this whole other dimension of meaningfulness of NDEs that kind of fell by the wayside in the rush to, figure out whether they're evidence for survival or not.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was a child, if I had a bad dream, what some people might call a nightmare, and I'd go and tell the adults about it, and they would say, oh, it's not real. It's not real. Well, it feels pretty damn real when you're in the middle of it all. So there's that dimension you mentioned there, people from a medical background. Some of them are saying, well, hang on, there is something going on here, but there's still many of them, I suppose, are still trying to come at it. Purely through a scientific viewpoint. I can understand that and say, well, what's repeatable here? How can we measure this? Can we hook them up to any machinery that might tell us something about it? And is it just, as many people have posited, is it just a dying brain, reactions going on physiologically within the brain that's having causing this experience? So there can be no quote unquote reality to it. But then that's your hardcore materialism coming in. If it doesn't take place in the realm of three senses and five dimensions, then it is like a dream. It's like quote unquote not real. So I suppose then bringing in this other layer of afterlife beliefs, which there's more religious scientists than most people think, but a lot of people from scientific background would dismiss out of hand, religious ideas about there being life before life or life after death or other realms of existence that are not on the physical plane.
And the point of the new book, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, is so I look at the afterlife beliefs cross-culturally in the context of near-death experience. I do this wide cross-cultural comparison of all these unrelated civilizations across the world, from the Egyptians to the Aztecs and everyone in between, and essentially wanted to see to what extent their beliefs were similar to NDEs, because if they are similar, then we can start looking at NDEs as a possible explanation for why they're similar, basically. But at the same time, that really challenges some of the scientific viewpoints about NDEs, especially when you start looking, in addition to the beliefs, I found actual accounts, verbatim accounts of near-death experiences in ancient China, ancient Sumer, ancient Aztec civilization, just, you know, kind of all over the world. There's references in the Vedas in ancient India. And the reason these are challenging is because they differ from contemporary NDEs. So just to give a couple of examples, in Western examples, you know, we're the kind of stereotypical idea we have is rushing through a tunnel to the other world. But cross-culturally, there's often isn't a tunnel at all. There's an example from Polynesia where the woman describes walking along a path to the other world, and she looks down and she can see footprints in the sand of all the souls who had gone there before her. And then as she's walking to the other world during her NDE, she sees somebody coming back in the opposite direction, and that's somebody who is finishing their NDE and is now returning to the body. So basically, it's, you know, it's the same thematic notion in the experience. They're still transitioning from this life to the other world, but they're not speeding through a tunnel. And that's important from a scientific perspective is the dying brain hypothesis, and people who are saying that, you know, there's a burst of energy at the end of life want to universalize NDEs and say, okay, everyone goes through this black tunnel, that means it's a certain part of the brain or consciousness shutting down or anoxia or hypercarbia or whatever the explanation is. But then if you have somebody who's not having a tunnel, that challenges the whole thing. And it's the same with life reviews. The big panoramic kind of life review that we're used to hearing about is just kind of non-existent in other cultures, even if they do have this idea of, you know, an evaluation of their former life on Earth.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. As you say, it challenges the scientific view on this. But also, I suppose, the kind of what I was driving at a little bit earlier, it would kind of give grist to the mill, perhaps, to some, you know, materialist point of view types who want to dismiss the near-death experience and say, oh, well, look at this, it's totally inconsistent. Well, of course, it's not. But your work is introducing more, like yours is the first book I've read that's pointed out so many differences in these experiences down time. And you mentioned some of the common elements that we think of, you know, the conventional modern Western view of the near-death experience, but they kind of do, even they don't have all those. You mentioned, you know, Raymond Moody's 15 elements. So there's variation there even. And the tunnel, the path, as you say, it's basically the same thing. You know, other common things, life review, sometimes absent. Then there's things like barriers, seems to be a very common thing. Light itself, if not moving down a tunnel, then moving towards light or being enveloped with light, you know, and feeling bliss, etc. And then, you know, meeting ancestors or loved ones or whatever. So despite, you know, your work is exploring the differences and the similarities, reading it, I would say that the cross-cultural consistency is remarkable evidence what there is of it. You know, you can focus on the similarity, you can focus on the differences, if you see what I mean, but depending on what, you know, what you're trying to do. So it's one of the things that I think your book is very good at is you're kind of bolstering the case that you're making in the title of the book and for the reality, quote unquote, you know, of the near-death experience. But at the same time, I think ultimately this strengthens the case. You're highlighting differences, but there's, you know, you're not undermining, in my opinion, you're not undermining the case for it, for the near-death experience being something meaningful. So in a strange way, I think giving, say, a purely scientific mind a bit of a reason to say, oh, well, I told you there's nothing to this, actually ultimately is strengthening the case, the ground that this is on.
Yeah, I do think that it could be used as a challenge to either argument, really, because, you know, material scientists could say, well, why are they so different? That means that there's nothing to them. But and then also people who believe that there are evidence for an afterlife, you know, there's this kind of hierarchies in the near-death experience world. And, you know, it's almost like a sort of new proto-religion or a kind of new age type religion. And people, I've read people online, like, you know, judging each other because, oh, well, I saw a being of light. Oh, well, I didn't see that. Is there something wrong with me? Or my beloved grandfather met me in the other world. And, well, why wasn't my wife there to meet me? You know, there's all these kind of confusing elements to them, which I think for some people undermine the idea that they're real experiences. And my answer to that is, why do people expect the afterlife to be the same for everybody? Because this life isn't the same for everybody. And we're also different as individuals. We're culturally different. So, our whole systems of symbolic thought and ideas and our touchstones for reality really are so much based in our personal experience. So I don't think once we're disembodied, if that's what happens, that suddenly we're cultureless beings and everybody has the exact same experience. So to me, that difference argument is not an argument at all.
Yeah, and if you look at the things that the activities and experiences that we physically have, or even psychologically, in our 3D five sense realm, me eating a cheeseburger and you eating a cheeseburger, we're not experiencing exactly the same thing, but
Right.
nobody's dismissing the fact that we're engaging in the same activity or having the same, the same similar experience, shall we say. One of the things that I think is very significant is that you're looking at original source material as much as possible, kind of afresh, because one of the things that kind of blights or can blight anything that involves historical research, archaeology, whatever type, is consulting what has third or fourth or fifth hand sources, consulting what's already been published, particularly when, as you say, when things get published and established in people's minds. So when you say near-death experience, absolutely, if I talk to any people casually about it, friends, colleagues, if they do know anything about it, they come back with what you just said, the classic Western NDE as written about in some, pop science books and whatnot. You looking at the source material, again, sorry, just to, that was my point, really reiterate that. I think that's very significant.
And there's a good example of that actually. The kind of received wisdom in ancient history, archaeology, religion about ancient Mesopotamian afterlife beliefs for hundreds of years, couple of hundred years, has been that people go to the afterlife and it's this kind of shadowy, vague half-life. It's like barely even experience, and people just kind of hang around there in this mopey, semi-conscious state. And so when I was looking at the Mesopotamian material, I was focusing on ancient Sumer because that was the earliest text. I fully expected to find that validated, and I was thinking, okay, this is going to be a challenge to my hypothesis here. That's not what near-death experiences describe. So how am I going to fit that in? How am I going to understand that in relation to the other cultures? But when I started looking afresh at the ancient texts, without relying on summaries of other scholars or kind of retellings of myths and things like that, I looked at the actual sources, including all their limitations, what's left out, what's not understood by translators. I started finding, references to beings of light, to traveling through darkness, to sun gods, who are obviously beings of light, to seeing relatives in the other world, evaluation of the earthly life. All this kind of stuff, which is similar to NDEs, references to joy and feasting and having banquets in the other world. And there's even, everyone's probably familiar with the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is an old Babylonian epic story myth.
Yes.
Before that, his actual Sumerian name was Bilgamesh, and there are a few texts and chapters to that epic that, didn't quite make the final cut. And one of them tells the story of the death of Bilgamesh, which is essentially NDE, because this was a real king. So this might be the world's earliest account of an NDE. It describes him lying on his deathbed. His soul leaves his body, travels to the other world, and he meets ancestors and beings of light. And he undergoes, a process of evaluation of his life so they can determine what's going to happen next, to in the next part of his afterlife journey. And they decide that he's going to be a judge in the other world. So it's kind of this, he becomes like one of them. So it's almost like this becoming divine. And then he returns to Earth after a banquet, a celebration is held in his honor, and he prepares for his funeral and prepares to die. So to me, that really kind of challenged everything that Assyriology has been telling us for the last 150 or 200 years. And the response from that community is not to engage with what I'm actually saying and engage with the evidence, but to say things like those examples are fringe, they're heterodox, they're not really what the Sumerians believe, or even more convolutedly, like they're saying that because they mean the opposite. Or they'll attack
Right.
the messenger and say, this is what happens when people from it's not really an engagement with the content and the argument. It's finding ways to adhere to the dogma.
Yeah, that sounds depressingly like Egyptology, you know, the gatekeepers in that, because that's, you know, that's rife with that sort of thing, really. But I'm not surprised to hear you speak about it in other sort of, you know, subgenres, for want of a better phrase, in archaeology. I used to attend a humanist meeting group. They'd have a gathering once a month, and they would have guest speakers, and I would go along if I thought the speaker sounded interesting. Well, not because I called myself a humanist, but it was just a social thing, really. But I did meet a lot of people there where, if because I was trying to sort of get speakers along from time to time that I thought might challenge the humanist point of view a little bit. But what I found with many of them, unfortunately, which is why I no longer attend the group, is they would obviously dismiss all this talk of near-death experiences as and the notions of an afterlife as wishful thinking. But it was almost like to con we say, well, okay, well, we've got a, maybe we get a scientist to come and talk about this. You know, maybe we get Rupert Sheldrake to come and talk about it. You know, because he's a credentialed scientist, you know, well respected. Anyway, maybe somebody like yourself, if you were in the country, you know. But there was this kind of apprehension that even looking into non-material phenomena, especially if you connect the word afterlife anywhere there, you're kind of letting God in by the back door. You know, because that's the whole idea, the whole thing that seemed to obsess so many of them, that if anything at all about experience out of the body or that, it's just letting, it's the religious fanatics are going to be, you know, whooping and punching the air, because we told you there is a God, but that's not what's being said. But that's kind of certainly, that's where I faced a lot of resistance. But I'd say, what were we afraid of? You know, I'd say that to anybody. What were we afraid of in looking at this? Because I said to these humanists, the ones who, you know, got militant about it, I said, look, if after death there is a black void of nothingness, well, I'm not going to be around to complain about it or to say, oh, I kind of thought there would be an afterlife. I'll just be gone. I'll be annihilated. If that's the way it pans out, so be it. But we'll find out. But we just have all this gathering evidence, and bearing in mind that so many people are reluctant to speak about these sorts of experiences because they get, you know, worried about getting called nuts. This gathering evidence suggesting that something is going on, and people like yourself are just looking at one, you know, one strand of all this. And this is experience that humans are having. You're not denying that dreams occur, you know what I mean? So why can't there be some other form of non-material activity, you know, in the, of, you know, purely in the mind, as it were? So there's just that apprehension that, you know, anything that isn't replicable in a lab and can't be measured and weighed and everything else, just by, you know, de facto doesn't exist.
Yeah, and that's really why I've framed all of my discussions in my books as this isn't an engagement with whether the soul survives death or not, or whether NDEs are true. I'm talking about, you know, I'm looking at it from a humanities perspective, from a history of religions perspective. So it accepts the fact that near-death experiences occur, but I'm not making any statements about what that experience is. And the reason for that is, well, it's a couple of things. One is that I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of interesting evidence, obviously, with the vertical observations and the people seeing souls of the dead of people who they didn't know had died during their NDE, and then they come back and it's verified. Things like that are, you know, pretty compelling. But I really want to stay in the kind of middle lane of that argument rather than coming down firmly on one side or the other, because I'm not a scientist, and so it's not up to me to evaluate the evidence scientifically. And that's part of the problem with near-death studies, is because the occasional time when scientists will dip their toe into the humanities, they inevitably get it wrong. So they'll come in and sort of dabble and say all near-death experiences around the world are the same, which is not true. Or they'll say there are no near-death experiences around the world, therefore they can't be real. So I'm hoping that, you know, my work will kind of be a wedge into the scientific near-death studies, and people will start considering the cross-cultural diversity of them when they start theorizing about, you know, the nature of the phenomenon, because they just haven't done that really very much.
No. In the city I live in, the cathedral here recently, there was an event on aimed at school-aged children, and it was entitled "God and the Big Bang," and this caught my attention. So I read the flyer about it, And you can tell from the title what it was attempting to do. Because there was one scientist speaking, there was going to be at least one member of the clergy speaking. So I don't know what the content of the workshops was as such, but it made me think about creation myths. And I'm thinking here that there might be some work that's been done similar to yours, but on world creation myths. One thing I noticed was how many common elements creation myths have, and just wondered if there could be a connection in some way, not necessarily directly with near-death experience, but some kind of similar process could be at work. Of course, often we don't know the origin of these stories. We just see, what they are, how they've been recorded from back in the mists of time. But as far as God and the Big Bang goes, it occurred to me, well, let there be light is very similar to a Big Bang. It just, just poof, everything just comes into existence. And if you have the, I'm getting into territory that's probably beyond the remit of our conversation here, but if you have, an idealist perspective that perhaps physical matter isn't fundamental, but consciousness is, then consistent with that is the idea that the physical reality could be thought up, to use the phrase, just suddenly into existence because it isn't fundamental, So it occurred to me, I don't know if you've ever, looked at creation myths or thought about that in this sort of context, but I think that's another interesting area of study, looking at what will the ancient civilizations and indeed indigenous peoples today have to say about how did the world come into being.
Yeah, I have looked at them a little bit for kind of comparative purposes with the afterlife stuff because I wanted to, again, kind of test the theories that I was making. But so for one thing, there's not like an experience that would underpin creation myths other than, maybe our own births, which we don't remember. And that's really more like an emergence of humans kind of myth. I think that as far as like creation of the world myths go, there probably is some similarity. There's a lot of descriptions of like a kind of primordial soup kind of thing, this hazy, celestial ocean or ocean of darkness from which life emerges. But the creation of humans is really pretty different across cultures. So, I mean, I read a quote once, I think it was Mircea Eliade, said something like, three quarters of the world's humans once believed that we all evolved from melon seeds. That doesn't mean that it's true. I think that's a great example. And then, and Aztecs believe that the human race was made when the god Quetzalcoatl ground up powdered jade and bones and then bled on it. And then that gave rise to the human race. So obviously those are different. But yeah, this idea of kind of nothingness and then something emerging from nothingness, I think is a little more similar. And that could come from, just conceptions of this of what it's like to be unconscious or semi-conscious or like a hypnagogic state or something, and the idea of the way our consciousness kind of emerges from a restful. And maybe there's an analogy with that, how people conceptualized creation of matter.
Another point that occurred to me earlier, I just neglected to mention it at the time, was, the materialists' worldview, and I mean that in terms of like, physics and metaphysics, but also just in terms of consumerism, that this world, this life is all there is, so you got to make the best of it while you can and get lots of nice stuff. That's relatively recent. I mean, there might have been phases of that in the past, but what seems to be coming down the ages to is that this worldview that we currently labor under, which I think is gradually changing. So maybe the last couple of 100 years, the scientific revolution, the industrial revolution fueled a lot of that. But people, as far as we could tell, thought quite differently about themselves and the world and their place in the cosmos, in the past, which definitely would have had an effect on what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people have always been concerned with, material, getting enough material goods to live a comfortable life. But I think that's true that, the consciousness of people in ancient Egypt wasn't, at least most people wasn't acquiring material objects and that kind of greed that we're seeing in contemporary society. Obviously it did happen at the priestly level and the royal level, but for the most part, people were concerned with, getting by and living a decent life. And otherwise, the idea of the afterlife was obviously really preoccupied people in ancient Egypt. Otherwise, that's where most of our artifacts from Egypt come from these tomb burial contexts.
Well, one thing you mentioned, priestly class there, royalty. One thing that definitely has occurred, and I think this definitely muddies the water here, is that the idea of the afterlife has been exploited to keep subjugated or people in poverty happy with their lot, because you might be living in squalor now, but don't worry, because this is just a temporary sort of almost like a punishment, and then you'll go to heaven later and everything will be all right for eternity. But the fact that that's been exploited, that sort of links it with institutionalized religion and sort of a stratified society, doesn't it? So for a lot of people, it's easy for them to believe that this is all just made up.
And it ties in with, Freudian kind of wish fulfillment ideas about the afterlife. These what I see as pretty simplistic explanations that, the afterlife grew out of a desire for a better life and out of a way of the elite to control the masses. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. And what I found in this book was in Egypt, China, and India, at least, possibly the others, I'd have to check. Their afterlife belief started out being, not being dependent on earthly behavior, and it wasn't like a judgment kind of scenario. Sure, your judgment, your earthly actions would impact your afterlife fate, but it wasn't like you're going to go to hell and be tormented and tortured and suffer if you did bad things, and if you did good things, you're going to go to heaven. It was more of a kind of mystical individualist approach, and more kind of transcendental, and more focused on transcendence and the divine. And then as time grew on, in Egypt with the later afterlife books, and in China and India, we see, and this is it's kind of corresponds with texts becoming more available to the masses, people becoming more literate, more pe these the kind of religious culture fanning out to more people in a more comprehensive way. We then start to see manipulations by the elite and the kind of birth of that binary heaven hell afterlife, and these almost loving descriptions of torments. Like in China, if you gossip about people, then in hell you're going to have an iron rod shoved through your tongue. It's these kind of the punishment will fit the crime things. So in other words, briefly, basically what happened, I think, was the initial afterlife impulse, I think, was rooted in near-death experiences and possibly shamanic experiences. But then gradually, as time went on, they became manipulated by the elite, but it didn't originate with the elite.
One thing that struck me again as soon as I started reading your book was these sort of cultural differences and the sort of various cultural contexts was I've also done a lot of work on UFOs, UAPs, just sort of what's the nature of this phenomena that they're undoubtedly happening are affecting people. And they've changed over time. That the flying saucer thing, for example, came about through a misrepresentation of an account, a UFO account, in the early stages of the mid-20th century, Roswell and all that. The witness at the time to the things that the pilot who witnessed the objects flying through the air said something about them moving like a saucer, whatever it was. The saucers don't move. I can't remember the details now, but he didn't say anything about them looking like saucers. But the newspaper report in a time before the internet, one of the main newspaper reports read, widely, said that he said they looked like saucers. And at that point, people started seeing flying saucers, literally, disc shapes. And all those images started to appear of the same. But you look back and, again, is something you may or may not have read much about, but down the millennia, you had chariots of fire, you had flaming wheels, you had, angels in the sky, all these sorts of things seen in the sky that kind of fit this bill, but often to do with people's perception. You're not going to see something that looks like a spaceship if you're experiencing this in, at the height of the Roman Empire or in ancient Egypt. Because there aren't any, as far as we know, there aren't any flying machines. There are no science fiction ideas about what alien spacecraft are supposed to look like. So it occurred to me that that was similar to, the differences in the near-death experience, that there is a, put it, a cultural context that informs the content, even if, as you mentioned, the experience is similar, you know, a path or a tunnel. It seems like it's the same thing, the same experience, more or less, the same function, if I can call it that, but just seen differently, literally experienced differently as two different things, a path or a tunnel. That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
LegalizeFreedom.com.